Some of us are outwardly successful, but inwardly feel unhappy and living a life lacking in purpose and meaning. The Necktie and the Jaguar by Carl Greer can help you discover what's important to you and how to go for it. For more information or to purchase the book, visit carlgreer.com. That's CarlGreer.com. Welcome to Cracked, the podcast, the program that slays the dragons of mental health by stripping away the shame, embarrassment, fear, and stigma. Because mental health isn't something that affects just some of us, it applies to all of us. Here to shine a new light on areas of mental health that often go unvisited are your hosts, Rebecca Shaper and Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome to Crack the Podcast, Slaying the Dragons of Mental Health with me, Sandy Sedgebeer.
And me, Rebecca Shaper.
Now, do you think there's just one of you, or do you ever secretly wonder if there could be more personalities hiding inside you? You know, like the inner critic that constantly puts you down, the procrastinator that second guesses every decision you make, or the mischief maker that eggs you on, whispering, go on, say it, do it, wear it. Well, we've all been taught to believe that we have a single identity or personality and to feel fear or shame when we can't control the inner voices that don't match the ideal of who we think we should be. Yet, according to Dr. Richard Swartz, all of us are born with many sub-minds or parts, and it's perfectly natural to think that some of them are so bad they must stay hidden. But the fact is, there are no bad parts. Dr. Richard Swartz has been transforming psychology for decades with his remarkably effective internal family systems model. And he is the founder of the Center for Self-Leadership, which offers three levels of training and workshops in IFS for professionals and the public. And he's the author of over 50 articles about IFS and five books, including his latest release, No Bad Parts: Healing Trauma and Restoring Wholeness with the Internal Family Systems Model. Dr. Richard Swartz, welcome.
Thank you, Sandy. I love that intro. You really get it, and it's exciting.
Good at it. So I've got a question for you, Richard. I hope you don't mind me calling you Richard. If I was a patient who came in with anxiety and depression, how would you help me understand my sabotaging or addictions with your theory, no bad parts? And how can you explain what you mean by no bad parts?
Okay. So what I mean, I'll start with the second question first. What I mean is that, as Sandy said, my basic assumption, and it isn't an assumption, it's something that I learned from clients. I learned all of this from 40 years of therapy as a therapist, that it's the basic nature of the mind to be subdivided that way, to have parts. And we're born that way because they all have valuable qualities and resources to give us in our life as we go through life. But they're forced out of their naturally valuable states by the traumas we suffer, especially when we're young, and by the bad parenting we experience, and forced into roles they don't necessarily like, but think are necessary to keep us safe. And at some point in your life may have been necessary. So if I were to, you know, you came in and complained about your addiction or your anxiety or depression, I would say, so, Rebecca, are you open to getting to know that part of you that makes you an addict? And you want to role play it for a second?
Sure. Let's go for it.
I'm not saying you're an addict.
No. I know that. Let's go for it.
Okay. Yeah. So, are you interested in getting to know this part of you and why it does this addiction thing?
Yes, I am, because I'm tired of it and I want to evolve. I want to put it behind me and understand why.
Yeah. And I totally get that sentiment. And, you know, I understand how you've tried to do that over and over, but it hasn't worked out very well. Is that right?
You're correct.
Yeah. So if you're open to it, we're going to try a different approach to that attic part. Would that be okay for a second?
Sure.
All right. So go ahead and focus on it and just see if you where you find that impulse in your body or around your body.
Okay.
Where do you find it?
In my solar plexus.
Okay. And as you notice it there, how do you feel toward it?
Anxiety.
Like you're afraid of it or?
No, I would say that it would be more anxiety slash calmness to it. I don't know if that makes sense.
So that's how it feels. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, but how do you feel toward that addictive part of you? In other words, do you still hate it and want to get rid of it, or do you?
Oh, I'd love to get rid of it.
Okay, again, I understand that. But for the purposes of this session, we're going to ask that part that wants to get rid of it to just give us a little space so we can get to know it instead and maybe even help it not have to do this job. And just see if that one who wants to get rid of it is willing to open a little space so you can open your mind to it.
Okay.
And now how do you feel toward that attic part?
Embracing it and want to learn more why.
Good, perfect. So go ahead and keep embracing it and ask it what it wants you to know about why it does this job. And don't think of the answer, just wait and see what comes to you as you ask that question.
Okay.
Yeah, and you don't have to share the answer with me, but also ask it what it's afraid would happen if it didn't do this inside of you. What's it afraid would happen?
Do you want me to answer that?
If you're open to it, yeah.
Sure. The unknown, probably. I know that it would probably be better, but it's that next step and a little bit of fear attached to that.
So there'd be fear. This attic part has fear of what would happen if it didn't keep you going this way. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, so fear of the unknown, I get that. But anything more specific that it's afraid would happen to you? Just ask and don't think. Just wait for an answer.
Okay.
You gave you an answer?
I'm kind of blank here, so.
Oh, okay, so nothing's coming.
Yeah. Okay. I'm not sure what you,
It's okay. All right, and are you still embracing it?
Yes, I'm trying to visualize it in my mind and say I do take that action. And what would be the next step? It would be a relief. And what am I afraid of not letting go of? I guess, say that it's been a part of my life for a long time. And so maybe it's part of grief. I'm not sure.
So there might be some grief to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. But at least for the moment, you feel some caring for it. And
yes.
How's it responding to your embrace?
It's nicely. Responding nicely.
Okay. All right. So thank it for allowing you to embrace it and let it know and get to know it a little bit and let it know you're going to keep working to help it do something it would prefer doing. and just see how it looks to that.
And have more compassion with it.
You do, yeah. It's great. Okay, so we can step out of the role play.
Okay, good.
I'm sure it's uncomfortable because you're not an addict, Rebecca. No, and so you're trying to think and respond.
I was trying to actually use one of my family members when I was growing up.
Okay.
Myself in their shoes. Okay.
It's interesting that Rebecca's brought up family members, because I was going to ask you, is it possible that some of our parts may not actually be our parts, but we've kind of imbibed them, taken them on?
Yeah, so that gets into the topic of burden. So these parts are in there to help us in our life, but they get forced into these extreme roles. They also get frozen in time during traumas in our lives. So they live as if we are still 5 or 6 or whatever the time was that you were hurt. And they think you're still that age. They think they still have to protect you like they did back then. And they take in extreme beliefs and emotions that came into your system from the trauma, like I'm worthless, or the world is terrifying, or whatever particular extreme belief or emotion it was. And then also, they often get stuck with what we call legacy burdens, which are these extreme beliefs or emotions that came down through your family lineage, entered your system. Mm-hmm. Have nothing to do with your life. It had to do with some traumatic event that occurred decades or even centuries earlier and just came down the generations and landed in your parts and or in your ethnic groups history. Or some of these are just floating around in our culture.
I agree with you 100%. I think a lot of it. All right, let me back up here. How can an individual determine whether it's came from the ancestors, your family lineage, your versus it's your own addiction?
Yeah.
To eliminate the trauma, trying to deal with the trauma.
Yeah. So the good news about all this work is you don't have to figure it out as a client or as a therapist, because when you get in there and say we had continued the dialogue with that addict part, and at some point you could ask it, do you carry somebody else's energy? Do you carry somebody else's impulse? It would tell you, yeah, I carry my father's energy. Do you like him to carry that? What?
Can we pause right there for a minute? I totally understand what you're saying. How do you know that's not your own thoughts versus it's really your soul speaking to you?
You can't know for sure, but I've been doing this 40 years and I can kind of tell when people are making it up. So I'll ask the part that's trying to please me by doing, you know, or trying to get through the session without having to get dirty. Just step out, just to let us actually run around in this inner world and ask these questions. And a lot of times you can tell because it's a total shock to the client. So,
I guess, and the answer is if something shifts, then it doesn't really matter.
That's right.
As long as something shifts.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So, if none of us is a unified consciousness, then multiple personalities are within us to some degree or another. What's the difference between a multifaceted mind and multiple personality disorder?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because that's what I'm up against, the stigma of MPD, which is now DID. And the way of thinking about that has been that we all have this unitary mind that got fragmented by trauma into these little shards of the broken vase. And the goal then becomes to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, to make all these parts disappear so you just have your one mind again. And that's the paradigm that most of our culture operates under. And that's what I've been trying to change, because it turns out that that diagnosis, just one end of the spectrum of what we all are, and what are called alters, alter personalities, are the same as what I'm calling parts, except that for those clients, their parts got blown apart much more and polarized much more by the terrible things that happened to them when they were kids. So that if one takes over, the others take off, for example. And there's a lot of vying for leadership. But if you didn't have that kind of repeated chronic trauma experience, you'll still have your parts. You just won't notice them in the same way that they do, because they don't need to take over in the same way. They're just kind of getting along for the most part. In some areas, they might be extreme and cause trouble in your life. And that's what I help people with. But I've worked with a number of clients who had that diagnosis of MPD. And that's basically what I learned, is that it's really the same phenomena. It's just one end of that spectrum.
What about an individual who is diagnosed, like my brother and my mother as well, with schizophrenia, and they had these hallucinations and they had these psychotic breaks? Mm-hmm. How can you explain that?
Yeah, and they hear voices and so on. Mm-hmm. So my take is that we all have biological predispositions, genetic predispositions for different conditions. Mm-hmm. Like I have one for migraine headaches and for asthma. And if I'm in a dusty room, I'll start to have an asthma attack, and it has nothing to do with my parts or my mental health.
Right.
But if I'm under a lot of stress and I'm facing something very scary and a part wants to take me out, it'll push the migraine headache button and I'll have a migraine headache. And it's a real headache. It's not like I'm imagining it. But I can find that part who tends to do that. And now I don't have migraine headaches anymore because I've worked with that part and it trusts it doesn't have to do that anymore. So for me, things like schizophrenia and various forms of psychosis, it's a very similar thing. There's a biological genetic component, a predisposition for having those kinds of delusions, and there's a part that when it wants to take you out, will push that delusion button. And you'll have a full-on psychotic experience. So it's not like you're pretending that. And you may hear these weird voices and you may see these strange things. But if we can work with the part that had to push that button and find what it's protecting and help all that heal, you won't have that same level of problem.
I've read of some people who practice what has been known as provocative therapy. With people who are delusional, and they kind of enter the delusion with them, and they can act usually, you know, by talking to the person as if the delusion's real, they eventually can get through it out to the other side.
Yeah, a lot of times if you fight with the client who's saying this delusional thing, let's say it's paranoia, and you're saying, no, they aren't out to get you. You're doing fine. Don't worry about it. It just makes that scared part that's giving you the delusion stronger, because it thinks you don't really get it. But if you, as you were saying, go into it and say, okay, let's really keep an eye out now. And, you know, my mother was demented at the end of her life, and I'd go visit her in the nursing home. And she had this delusion that her father was wanting to come and get her and take her back to the farm and needed her. And so my brother, who's a physician, would come in and say, no, Mom, it's 2020. And, you know, and I'd come in and say, yeah, okay, well, let's check it out. Maybe we should get a cab or something. And she'd say, you know, I'm kind of tired. Maybe we'll do it tomorrow. it would just fall down.
Yeah. Yeah, enter their reality. I mean, you talk in your book about, you know, these exiled parts. If we say to people, no, 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 you're just imagining that, we're actually, you know, we're exiling the part, we're ignoring the part, we're treating it as if it doesn't exist.
Yeah.
And
go ahead, Rebecca.
A trust issue is very important.
Yeah.
Very, very important.
That's right. Yeah.
Yes.
In those situations, for sure.
And yeah.
Yeah, so this is a kind of radical departure from most traditional ways of working with these things, because if you believe in your bones that there are no bad parts, and that even the ones that are doing these kinds of things are doing it to try and protect you for some reason.
Right.
Or because they carry, as we talked, a legacy burden. Then instead of fighting with them, I'll try to help my client separate from them a little bit, so that, just like we did, Rebecca, so how do you feel toward that addict part, rather than I am the addict part, you know, because when it takes over, you just feel it all, or I am the delusional part, I am the paranoid part. You know, what was the movie, A Beautiful Mind? Do you remember that movie?
Yes. Yeah. Oh, I love that.
The beginning of the movie, John Nash is totally blended with that paranoid part, and he's got you in his, you know, in his paranoid thing. And then later he separates from it, and he sees it across a field from him as a child. And that's what we do. We help people separate from the part, not to try and ignore it or get rid of it, but to just get to know it from this other place we call self, with a capital S, that is there when you separate from your parts. It's just this essence in us that's just beneath the surface of these parts. And when you enter that state, you have a natural curiosity about the whatever part you're working with, and you're calm, and you're also confident relative to it. And often you're actually, like you did, you suddenly feel compassion, like you do want to embrace it.
Yes.
Rather than fight with it. And when in that state, you can get to know how it's trying to protect you. And often it does take you into scenes in the past. And you can get whatever parts you left back there out of those scenes and actually help them transform and heal.
Do you try to get the client, if say they're back in a scene when they were having extreme trauma in their childhood, how far do you go back into that type of trauma in order for the person to really understand that there are no bad parts? I hope I'm explaining myself right.
How far back do you go? Or
how deep? I think you said how deep.
How far? I hate to use the word push, but how far do you work with the client when there's such severe trauma that, you understand what I'm saying?
I do understand what you're asking.
Yeah.
So I learned the hard way, the folly and the danger of pushing people. So when I'm working with somebody, what we found was they'll have, and most all of us have, what we call exiled parts, which are parts of us that would be those before they were hurt, these playful, loving, carefree, creative inner children, but those parts are also the most sensitive parts of us. So they're the ones that get hurt the most by the abandonments or the rejections or the traumas in general. And after they get hurt, now they carry the burden of worthlessness or terror or emotional pain or shame. Now we don't want anything to do with them, because they can overwhelm us with those feelings, and they're stuck in those scenes, and they can pull us back into those scenes. And so we try to lock them away inside in inner basements or abysses or cysts, and not realizing that we're locking up our most precious qualities a lot of the time, thinking we're just moving on from the memories, sensations, emotions, and beliefs of the trauma. And, you know, the U.S. is, if nothing else, a big move-on culture. It's a rugged individualist, don't look back, You can't change what happened. Just get over it and move on.
Yeah.
So all of us have a bunch of these exiled, young, tender parts that got locked away just because they got hurt. And then when you have a lot of exiles, you feel a lot more delicate and the world is a lot more dangerous because anything could trigger that. Mm-hmm. And if it gets triggered, it's like explosions of flames of emotion that can take you out and make it so you can't function. So we have to have another set of parts who are forced from their naturally valuable roles into the roles of protecting us or protecting those exiles or keeping them contained. And some of them do it by managing the outside world so nothing triggers those vulnerable parts. And others do it by, if a part did get triggered in exile, reacting in a very extreme way to try and get you higher than the flames or to distract you till they burn themselves out. So these are two classes, different classes of protectors. The point of all of this is I learned the hard way to work with protectors before we go to exile and to work with them to get permission to go to these very vulnerable places that are stuck in the past. Because when I used to try to push to get there and would succeed, there would be what we call big backlash reactions. You know, the protectors would punish my client in scary ways shortly after our sessions, actually.
Yeah.
So that's why this model is very ecologically sensitive. These are delicate inner ecologies.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to help people learn the rules of the ecology and respect the protectors of it and do everything with permission rather than pushing.
Just baby steps, it sounds like. Just like a peak.
Sometimes it's not baby steps. I mean, once you get permission, you can go very far, very fast, and it looks very emotional. But the baby steps are often in the getting of permission.
Yeah.
And these protectors have a lot of realistic fears a lot of the time. Like, if I open the door to that, I'm going to be flooded, and I'm not going to get out of bed for a week. So we have to have answers to those fears. And so if I were talking to you, I'd say, that makes sense. I hear that's happened in the past, but this is how we can handle that. I know how to handle that. You won't, in this work, you won't be flooded. You'll feel a lot, but it'll be temporary. And then once you've completed the witnessing of what happened to you back there, we can get the part that's stuck back there out to a safe, comfortable place. And then we can help it unload all these feelings you've been trying to contain all this time. And you'll be freed up to do something entirely different.
And is there shame? Do you find a lot of have shame wrapped around it?
Totally. Yeah. The exiles often have this shame and worthlessness. And like a kid, you know, if a parent is doing something to a child, it's too scary for the child to blame the parent. So the child will blame themselves.
Right.
And so most of these inner children do carry this sense that I'm really bad or nobody likes me, nobody values me. And with that comes a kind of survival terror because as children, we were born with the knowledge that if we're not valued by our caretakers, we're going to die. And there's truth to that. So these exiles carry all this terror in there about survival, and that often drives the extremes of our protectors.
We're going to take a little break now, but I mean, this is absolutely fascinating.
Yes.
And we'll get deeper into it when we return. You're listening to Crack the Podcast, and today we're talking with Dr. Richard Swartz, founder of Internal Family Systems Model, a paradigm-changing model that gives us a powerful approach, not only for healing trauma, addiction, depression, anxiety, procrastination, and more, but many other issues too. And he shares them all in his latest book, No Bad Parts. We'll be back with more from Dr. Richard Swartz and how we can learn to love all of our parts and in the process heal ourselves, our culture, and our planet after the break.
The Real Conscious Connection. OM Times Radio. IOM FM. OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Hello, I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, host of OM Times Magazine's flagship radio show, What is Going OM? My passion is sifting through information, research, and innovations from New Thought teachers, speakers, and researchers pushing back the boundaries of what we know about life, energy, metaphysics, and the universe. I love shifting perceptions about who we are, why we're here, and how quickly impossible becomes normal when we open our minds, expand our awareness, and accept that the only limits that exist are those we place upon ourselves. So if you're the kind of forward-thinking, eager investigator of what lies beyond the current reality that most perceive, why not make a date to come play with me in the field of possibilities at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time every Thursday, and together we can discover what's really going on.
Worried about your friend but don't know how to reach out?
You can say how are you or get a fake tattoo. You can ask with an app if it works for you. You can chat with them in VR. It's all good if you think you should check in. Yeah, you should.
Whatever gets you talking.
Reach out to a friend about their mental health.
Whatever gets you talking.
Learn how you can help at seizetheawkward.org.
Welcome back.
I'm curious about this question. Do you believe that some of the bad parts are our archetypes? And can you elaborate on that?
Do you mean in the Jungian sense of archetypes? I'm not sure.
For instance, the invisible child, uh-huh. The saboteur.
Yeah. So yes and no, in the sense that there are common roles across people. Like most everybody has a inner critic, for example. I think you mentioned that in the opening, Sandy. And then there are saboteur parts, like you said. There are often protectors that can get very, very angry. And so there are common roles that parts are forced into across people, which you could call archetypes. But once released from those roles, they do something entirely different because that's not their nature. So I'm not big on categorization beyond the three groups that I mentioned, managers, firefighters, and exiles, which again are just the roles. Like the, what was the child you mentioned at first?
The invisible child,
felt invisible, or
yeah, because of all the trauma that was going on, seeing the parents, and all they wanted to do was just hide and run away.
Yeah, so lots of us have that part, and that's not who that part is. That's the difference.
Right. I'm trying to say. Right.
That's what happened to it. But once you heal it, once you unburden it, release that belief that it has to be invisible, it will transform into a happy child.
Yeah.
Then it becomes that the happy child.
So, I like that.
Yeah.
In No Bad Parts, you share some exercises, you know, for mapping out our parts and accessing the self and working with, you know, a challenging part, a protector, or identifying triggers. Can you give us a few examples?
I mean, lead an exercise or just describe it?
Just describe some of the exercises that you can do.
Yeah, well, one, the first exercise I'll often do is I would ask each of you to think of a protective part of you that you might want to get to know better. And just for sake of playing with this, either of you have a not an exile, but a protector in mind that you might want to get to know.
Well, that's a challenging one, because after reading your book, you know, I think I'm aware of a few protectors, although they don't present themselves in a very polite way.
Okay, well, let's most everybody has an inner critic, right? And I would guess that each of you do as well.
Oh, yes.
So in the exercise, I would do some version of what Rebecca and I did earlier, which is focus on it, find it in your body. Most people find it in their head, but sometimes other places. And then this question, as you notice it there, how do you feel toward it? Because that immediately sets up a situation where there's a you that's different from this critic. And in answering that question, you're going to tell me how much of what I call yourself with a capital S is present. So if, as you said, Rebecca, initially, you hate it and you want to get rid of it, that wouldn't be self, because self doesn't hate anything. Self has compassion and has these C words, what I call the 8 C's: curiosity, confidence, compassion, calm, clarity, creativity, courage, and connectedness. So that's who you are at your essence. And so I'm listening and answering that question, how do you feel toward it? I'm listening for something like that. I'm just kind of curious about why it calls me names, said from a calm place. And any departures from that, I'm asking those parts to open space, because self will pop out spontaneously when there's enough space. So how do you feel toward the critic? You know, just, I'm interested in why it calls me names all day. Okay, then ask it and wait for the answer. Don't think of an answer. Just focus the question on that place in your body and ask what it wants you to know about why it calls you names all day, and just wait for the answer to come. And so then there's a pause, and then I'll also say, and ask it what it's afraid would happen if it didn't yell at you all day like this. And in answering that question, most people will hear you'd be hurt, or you'd be lazy, or some other thing would happen. And now you've learned how it's protecting you and why. And so then I would say, okay, I'd like you to show it some appreciation for trying to protect you this way, even if it drives you crazy. Just let it know you get it's trying to take care of you, and see how it reacts to your appreciation. Most people say it's softened, like you said. And ask it this question: if we could go to what it protects, so if we could go to the pain, or if we could go to the part that is kind of lazy and indulgent, and we could heal or change that, so it didn't have to worry about that happening, would it still want to do this job, or might it like to do something different? And you would be amazed at how many times people hear it would like to do something entirely different. It really hates having to yell at you all day. It only does it because it saw when your father yelled at you when you were a kid, you seemed to respond. So it's taking your father's voice and it's just, you know, kicking your ass. And it doesn't realize it's not working, because it just polarizes with other parts that become those inner saboteurs, but it doesn't know what else to do. You know, it's like the man in a hole with a shovel. It just knows to dig deeper. So, yeah, so that would be one exercise, would be just to get to know an inner protector, what it's trying to protect, show it appreciation, and start to negotiate a new relationship.
You say in the book, now I'm getting some feedback. You talk about, I don't know if anybody else is hearing it, and if it's annoying, please tell me.
It's gone.
Good. You talk in the book about how you can turn that part of you into something far more supportive, like the inner critic could become the cheerleader. Yeah. How do you actually negotiate with that part to get it to them become something really supportive?
Yeah, so most of these protective parts won't change until what they protect has been changed or healed. So if the critic is saying, if I lighten up on you, you're just going to be idle and you're not going to do any work. It's not going to lighten up until you've worked with the part that would do that. So, but once you do work with that part and come back to the critic and show that's not a danger anymore, then we just ask, what would you like to do instead? And to our amazement, most of them want to do kind of the opposite of what they've been doing. And so the critics often do want to become cheerleaders or at least advisors. They don't want to yell at you. They just want to help you be discerning maybe in your life. The part that wants to make you hide now wants to help you get out in the world and so on and so on. So it isn't a matter of, again, us imposing anything in there. It's just asking, what do you want to do now? And the part will tell you what it's, you know, what my mind is actually designed to do.
What if that, okay, so you hear what the part really wants to do and the person says, well, I don't feel like doing that. So then what? Do you just got to keep working at it or?
You mean if it says what it wants to do is a new role?
Yes, and the individual says, no, I don't want to do that.
Okay, so then
what's the next step after that?
Then let's find the part that doesn't want to do it and see why and hear from it. So it is a big internal family in there, mm-hmm. and everybody has a voice. And so, mm-hmm. and you bring them all to the table and you're the leader. You know, it's like a board meeting or a family meeting. Okay, you don't want to do this? You know, you don't want to be on this podcast? Okay, well, I'll hear from you. And you're dying to be on the podcast? Okay. Well, let's see if we can work something out.
What about those reactionary parts, you know, where you suddenly find yourself getting triggered by someone and then you think, why did I do that? You know, why did I say that? What part of me, you know, is so upset by this?
Yeah.
That's a bit harder, I think, to dig into some of those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there's also an exercise in the book along those lines. So if I was leading you in it, I would have each of you think of a person in your life that seems to trigger you in a big way.
Yeah, I've got one.
So do I.
Okay. If you want to try it for a second, we'll do it. So in your mind's eye, put that person in a room by him or herself, and you're outside the room looking at the person through a window. And just tell me when that's in place.
Okay.
And as you look at the person, have them do the thing that gets to you. And just notice what happens in your body and your mind as you get triggered.
For me, it's a kind of knee-jerk reaction. It's a constriction, but it's also a, you know?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Okay. How about for you, Rebecca?
For me, it's like, why would you do that?
Yeah, it's like a confusion or puzzle part.
Yes, it's like, Is that part of projection? I mean, where does projection play a role in this? Well,
as I say, these parts are stuck in bad places, and they'll see people in the outside world through the eyes of what they experienced when they were young. So they would see a person who did something as like, you know, maybe your father that did that to you that was similar. But So now you have, now you each notice a protective part. Mm-hmm. And you can notice how the effect it has on your body and what impulses it gives you and all that. And then at some point, I would say, we're not going into that room, so it's safe for this part to relax. But stay with it. And ask it to separate from you a little bit And then I would have you begin a dialogue with it about why it jumps up so big with this particular person. And you would learn a lot about that.
Yeah.
And learn a lot about the projections it has about that person.
Yep. Mm.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I know Rebecca had a question about your interest in psychedelics and MDMA. Rebecca?
Sure. You talk about your interest in MDMA, otherwise known as ecstasy. With IFS therapy, can you elaborate on why you feel the client benefits from MDMA?
Yeah, so many psychedelics, for some reason, I have no idea why, allow protector parts to relax very quickly, almost like they go to sleep. And when they do, you access a lot of what I'm calling self, those C word qualities. So with MDMA, you stay in your body and your heart opens enormously and you just love everybody around you and you feel connected. So you feel compassion and connection, two of the C words, toward people in general, but also the people in the room with you. And that state invites a lot of these exiled parts to finally get a chance to have some, you know, audience with you. And so there's a guy named Michael Mithoffer who started he ran the phase, he's running the trials for the FDA getting, approving of MDMA. And in the phase one trials, he's an IFS therapist. He kept track of how often spontaneously, without any cueing from the therapist, the subject would suddenly start doing IFS. Like he might see his rage and he sees he's got it locked in a cage and that was a mistake. And he's going to open the door and get to know it and thank it for protecting him in Iraq and so on and so on. And so it was very validating to me. It was like I just stumbled onto a way we already know how to heal ourselves. Because over 70% of the people would do this, would just spontaneously start to work because they access so much of what I'm calling self. And self knows how to heal. It just, once you get in that state, you know what to say to these parts to help them or to embrace them like you did. Or it knows how to heal in the outside world too. You automatically say the right words to the person you're fighting with. And they calm down and they sense the safety of your presence. And so I don't feel a huge need most of the time with clients, but when we get stuck, we can ask them if they'd be interested in trying a psychedelic sessions, something. Ketamine is now the one that's legal. So that's the one that I tend to use and it has a different effect, but it also accesses a lot of what I'm calling self. And so it just can facilitate the healing process.
It's interesting how much research is being done now with psychedelics, psilocybin, the trials with people who are dying and they're finding they're much calmer about the whole process, less anxiety and addiction and, all kinds of things.
Yeah, if you want to get spiritual about it, so for me, self is a piece of something much bigger. This essence inside of us there's a big self, the capital B, that's almost like a field or a wave. And when you, with something like psilocybin and also ketamine, you can actually enter that wave and people meditate to do it and they feel this unity consciousness, this non-dual, they feel connected to everything. And there's also a sense that there's a lot more than just this world. Like when you die, you're not gonna leave really, it's a transition. You're just going into another state. And that's really very comforting to people who are facing that. And so we have a project with IFS and psilocybin and at the University of Nebraska now. And we're working with IFS and psilocybin, actually, and also ketamine with eating disorders with a group, another group. So we're trying to do our homework, trying to get the research.
So all these drugs that were banned back in the 60s and 70s, you know, didn't actually do us a service. Yeah. And they're only now coming around again and people are going, oh, okay, there's something here.
Yeah, you know, Timothy Leary made it too loose. And, you know, these are potent and so they're also dangerous. And so needs to be in a controlled environment.
Yeah.
And so there were reasons to not just let it go the way they were. But now we're coming to see that if in a controlled environment, they can be very, very powerful medicines.
Have you ever had a client that has had an adverse reaction to it?
No, but yeah, well, what I'll say is, you know, I talked earlier about backlash, and sometimes because in the medicine session, you can go very quickly to these very raw parts. There might be other parts in the integrative session or after the session that will try to punish the client for having done that. And that can be misinterpreted as some kind of real scary episode. If you don't think of it as, oh, there's this part that got upset that we did this, so let me talk to that one and see what it wants us to know about why it's so upset. So that's partly why I'm trying to make IFS at least one of the maps to the psychedelic territory, because it helps the facilitator not overreact to these kinds of things. And if the facilitator can stay in this place of confidence and open-heartedness, that's all contagious. And so then the subject doesn't get freaked out by some backlash experience.
I've got another question. I have so many questions. Sorry.
Well, we are almost out of time, so it's going to have to be a quick one. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Okay, so you're healing the patient. What about the family members? Because I do believe that you've got to heal the family as well. Can you sum up that in about, 3 minutes?
Oh, less than that, much less than that. Probably a minute.
Two minutes. Do you incorporate the family as well?
Yeah, you know, I'm still a family therapist. I have a PhD in that. And so I'm always keeping an eye on the external environment of the client. And I want to, you know, if I'm working with an individual, then I want to be sure that the family's not they're not going to be the ones to backlash with the changes that are coming up. So I might gather all the family members in for a session and talk over what we're doing and ask each of them about their parts that are reacting to the patient.
And yeah, I bet that's fascinating. This is such a fascinating topic. I mean, and this really is taking therapy into a whole other arena. And from where I sit, it's looking like a very holistic, you know, kind of process and very spiritual in some respects. I wish we had more time because there's so much more that we wanted to talk to you about, you know, the retrieval part, which is, you know, what shamans do with soul retrieval. I mean, this is a fabulous book, Richard. Fabulous
Thank
book.
You. Thank you so much, both of you. Really enjoyed my time with you.
I got goosebumps because I love it. So thank you. The bit
that I like best is that someone can pick it up and they can do some of it for themselves. Yeah. Yes. You know, they don't have to, you know, be in therapy or be able to afford a therapist. And it's every part of our lives, our relationships, everything can be helped here.
Totally. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you.
I really feel like you guys prepared, and I really appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. We love the book, both of us. We really do.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. We do have to kind of wrap it up now very quickly. So I just want to tell our audience that the book is published by Sounds True. It's a fabulous book. And for more information about Dr. Schwartz's work, go to the ifs-institute.com and read the book. My goodness, you'll learn a lot about yourself and about others as well.
And it's easy reading.
Very easy reading. Yeah, and very good reading. So that's it for today, I'm afraid. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another edition of Crack the Podcast. Till then, it's goodbye from me.
And me, Rebecca Schaefer.
And thank you again, Dr. Schwartz.
And thank you both. I really enjoyed it, as I said.
Thank you. Okay, and don't forget, remember there's a crack in everything. It's how the light gets in.